All right, I might turn. Got it. I might turn my video off. I might turn my video off just because it uses less internet, and I think you're gonna come in more clearly if I'm not on video.
Okay.
But I'm still here. Good to see you guys.
Yeah. And interrupt at any time.
All right.
Diatribe. Yeah. Hi, Karen. Okay. So I was going to start with marine facilities. The marine facilities are the boat harbor, the float system connected to the dock, the beach is now considered part of marine facilities, and the restrooms, the one at the beach and the one in the Salmon River Park here. We added to that the shed this year. So the boat harbor now has a gathering place for disgruntled employees, where we keep all of our tools and things. Normally when I've done this in the past, I've always done it outside. It's a lot easier for me to think walking around down at the beach, but so those are the marine facilities. The marine facilities coordinator's responsibility is maintaining those, making sure that they're being used properly and within the bounds of the intentions of the city of Gustavus. And the marine facility coordinator job is 10 hours in the shoulder seasons, April to mid-May and mid-September to the end of December. And then it's a 6 day a week, 6 hour a day job in the summer. And that time is spent observing the activities, mostly at the dock and the boat harbor, making sure that the charter fishermen have a place to do the stuff they do, and that the locals have a place to get in and out of the water. And as part of the float system, we have the 200 foot long steel float and 100 foot long wooden float, and then four skiff floats, and the four skiff floats can hold up to 16 skiffs. And a lot of marine facility coordinator time is spent making sure that these are being used according to our rules, and that people are moving their boats on and off them. Did somebody fall? Yeah, and then that's the marine facilities coordinator's job, making sure that. Yes. Yep. I wasn't quite done. Karen does bring up a good point that myself as the marine facilities coordinator, when I was hired, Barb Miranda told me to enforce the spirit of the law rather than the letter of the law. And so that is how I approach the job. In my life, I find arbitrary rules to be unnecessary. And so I think that the community of Gustavus, the reason why we don't have law enforcement and why we choose to have the minimum amount of enforcement by the city that we do have, is because we're a community of like-minded people who wanted to govern themselves rather than being governed by arbitrary rules. And so that is how I approach the job. And because of that, another big part of the marine facilities coordinator job I found is just talking to the community. I pretty much hear it all. If you have a problem with the city or anybody inside the community, you're probably going to talk to the marine facilities coordinator about it. And I've found that just listening to people and trying to funnel their complaints or requests to the proper places was a big part of my job. If if I had to do percentages, I would say that 20% of my job was spent doing maintenance and 80% of my job was spent talking to people. And so I don't know how the new Marine Facilities Coordinator will approach the job. I'm hoping that if I'm part of the hiring team, which I assume I will be, that we'll find somebody with the right attitude. I think that the skill set, you could learn the skills of the Marine Facilities that the Marine Facilities Coordinator needs. Anybody could learn those, but that it's going to take the right attitude. And we can see that because I'm the third Marine Facilities Coordinator and the other two had what I would call the wrong attitude for the job. And that's why they didn't continue to do it longer than they did. So yeah, each spring and fall, we move the floats in and out. And we do that preferably with local help. We did it with all local help this year. And some years past, we've had to hire outside boats or operators to help us with this. But this year, we were able to do it with the help of Fairweather Construction, Brian Todd, and Western Marine. The Marine Facilities Coordinator works with DOT on making sure that the dock is maintained properly and is being used correctly also. That was something that I don't think probably went on before, but Jeff and I had a relationship and we were able to help each other. And make both of our jobs a little more easy to do by working together. So I think that's about it. Do you have any questions,
Janine? The question that I would have, or just is thinking in terms of how do the people, both the charter fishermen as well as locals, do they tend to, is it a hassle to enforce it, or do they tend to, you know, do things the same way in the spirit of what they're supposed to be doing? You know, I guess is just what I'm wondering, how much compliance and stuff like there is and how much of a hassle you have, or if it mostly just goes pretty smoothly.
That's a great question. Unfortunately, definitely in the beginning, it was a let's wait and see. You know, what can we get away with? I used to joke that when I would come down to the dock in the afternoons, I would hear Ben. And if I didn't know any better, I would think that people were saying, hey, look, it's Ben, come to say hi to me. But really it was a warning cry down the dock, letting other charter fishermen know that the only person with any enforcement powers was now in the vicinity, and so they should stop doing all the things they were doing that they knew they shouldn't be. And that would be feeding the sea lions or feeding the birds, cleaning fish on the float instead of in their boat, some similar stuff like that. So I think that as they got to know me better, they realized that my number one intention and was not enforcement. So my attempts at enforcement were not to tell people what they had to do, but to explain to people what the rules were. And then if I came back and they were doing it again, I would explain it again and maybe emphasize why there were certain rules. And if they did it again, then I would explain it again. And I think I wore a lot of them down just through telling them the same things repeatedly. That's the charter fisherman piece of that. And then the locals are the same way. Some locals want, this just like you would assume, I would think, some locals want to do the right thing because it's the right thing. And that, to me, is the right reason to do something. But some locals want to get away with as much as they can. And so the same people that you would think would be doing that in some other situation would be doing that there. And the Hardest thing is just keeping the boats moving around so that people don't use one of the spots as their parking spot for the summer. When I first started out, most people that kept their boats year round in the boat harbor were not registering their boats because nobody was enforcing that rule. I can only think of two exceptions. Everyone that I asked to register their boat started registering their boat and has continued to register their boat since then. And so one of the people who still doesn't just told me flat out that he'd lived here since before I was born and he never had to pay for a spot there before. And he wasn't going to pay for a spot now because he didn't want the city. And I could, you know, take my request and stick it wherever I wanted to. And that's been the case since then. His boat's still sitting down there full of water without a registration sticker on it. And there's not a whole lot that at the time I came back, I don't remember now if it was Barb or if it was Cal, but I explained the conversation to Cal and if it was Cal and he said, you know, you're going to have some of those and it's not worth the city's time to worry about it. You know, just let it sit there and whatever. And the other gentleman who had decided that he was going to stick his nose up in the air about the registering his boat. One day I came down into the boat harbor and he had a stern anchor on as well as a bow anchor. And as the tide came up, the stern anchor didn't allow for his boat to rise properly. And so over the course of about 2 hours, he didn't have a sticker on his boat. So it's not like I could have called him even if I wanted to, but yeah, I watched the water come up over the stern of his boat and fill up the back and filled up his outboard as it went down underwater. And so when I saw him again, I explained to the situation what I saw and told him if he'd have a sticker on his boat, I would have had his number in my computer and I would have been able to call him to let him know what was going on. And he wasn't happy with me about that either, but that is how when people didn't want to pay, that's how I explained it to him, is that you're paying for a service that you hope you don't need, but that the city is offering. You know, good storage, somebody watching over your stuff, making sure that nobody's down there vandalizing it or that it's sinking in the boat, in the river. And so for the most part, I would say that most people have wanted to do the right thing. Oh, the other thing I was going to say about that is that the problem with the charter fishermen became untenable as far as the feeding the sea lions and the birds go. And I requested that the city council put up a camera or something to back me up, because it was suggested that maybe I should just stand down there and just take pictures all day long of them feeding the sea lions. But the problem with that is I have to work with those people every single day. And so the idea of me standing down there and taking pictures of them working didn't seem like it was going to create a good work environment. And so I asked the city council for help. And they sent out a letter, which I could forward to you if you were interested, and basically said that we're no longer going to solely punish or threaten to punish the charter fishermen for their bad behavior. We're going to punish the companies. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to ban your company for 1 year from using our float system if we see any of your employees feeding sea lions. And both Greg Taylor and Anglers Inn, the two biggest companies in town, charter companies, they hired all new staff So we had 16 or 17 new captains to start this season. And instead of training those people to do it wrong or even having anyone here who could give an example of how they could do it wrong, they trained them how to do it right and explained to them that they refused to rehire any of those people for breaking the rules. And if any of these people broke the rules, they would not be rehired either. And so this year I didn't see a single person drop any kind of fish or anything into the water near the floats. So that kind of cleared up the other half of the problem areas that I've run into as the marine facilities coordinator. The other thing is that we have people who illegally dump stuff in the boat harbor. We kind of know who those people are. And I don't know, maybe they do it because they don't hide it anymore. They just like set a bucket of their feces or whatever in the boat harbor. And then I come along and pick it up and take it to the landfill for them. So we do have a few things like that. We've had a few cases of vandalism, kids spray painting on boats. We did put up cameras to see game cameras to see if we could catch the kids doing it, but we didn't, we were unable to. So that, I think that's pretty much the problems, and none of them were things that I felt were so overwhelming or anything. Most of the time I was able to just talk to the people and sort it out. I don't know if she has any more questions. Do you have any more questions, Janine?
Well, good. No, thanks for that. And I'm especially happy to hear that the situation with the charter fishermen got the onus put on the companies rather than the individuals, and have that problem taken care of, because that had been something that was an ongoing thing that was, yeah, hard to fix, but it sounds like you guys did a great job in coming up with a solution to that.
Yes, I agree, yes. And so I'm supposed to also talk about the treasurer job, and I think, you know, because Phoebe did her presentation, because there's nobody new here, and because Phoebe did her presentation and you were part of that, I do have better working knowledge of it than I did a few weeks ago. And I'm sure that as time goes on, I will continue to have a better idea of it. But, you know, basically the treasurer's responsibilities are making sure that the money flow is coming in and going out, and that everything is being done according to the policies and procedures of the city of Gustavus. The treasurer is responsible for creating the budget with the mayor and the city administrator, and I'm sure there will be more council members and community members be part of that. Responsible for making sure that any businesses that are failing to pay taxes or do things according to our policies and procedures, that those things are rectified in a timely manner. And responsible for creating spreadsheets to show the flow of monies. The treasurer works closely with the other department heads to make sure that they're spending spending their money properly, and that they have the money that they want to spend, and basically just oversees all financial activity for the city of Gustavus. And then, you know, I think that person also shares the HR responsibilities with the city clerk and now with the city administrator. So I don't really know if you have questions, I would be happy to answer them. I don't know exactly what else to say about the treasurer's job other than it's exactly what you think it is, but it's more fun. Thanks, Sally.
Ben just kind of gave
up. So the thing that I would was wondering is about the flow of the money. And so specifically,
I'm sorry, Janine, you cut out it right after specific. Is it possible that you hit mute? No. Oh. See. That's okay. I still have 7 minutes.
All right.
And we'll just sit and wait for her question.
Welcome back, Janine. So you guys,
I dropped and I did just reconnect. Can you hear me again?
Yeah, we lost you during the middle of your question.
You said specifically. Are you there?
So I dropped and then I reconnected, but right now I have a screen that says that you are starting.
Yeah, we're just waiting for you. If you remember what your question was to Ben, we can start there and then we can move on to the fire department.
Okay, I think I'm back again.
I am recording this as well. So if it isn't working out for you, you can always go back and listen to the recording.
Okay, well, hopefully it drops. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, if you remember your question that you were asking, Ben, we can start back up there.
Oh, yes. So the question I had for Ben just had to do with helping with the logistics of tracking the projects and things. So as we pass the ordinances to spend money, you know, in things such as different projects, how do we, so for example, the one for the beach. And so the beach trail, we, you know, pass that, spend the money to do the beach upgrade for the trail. How do we find or track that actually is going to happen or did happen? And how do those updates happen to us? How do the council members kind of know how those projects are being fulfilled, I guess?
Okay. So is when you guys, when the council votes on something and approves it, then it starts. That is the start of it. Not if you like when you guys funded the beach trail project, we started creating a file and on the computer in a folder here at City Hall where we'll track what goes on. The way that the council will be made aware of it is there's a capital project spreadsheet that unfortunately Eduarda had stopped keeping up on, and so the council stopped getting it. But while Phoebe was here, we got it all back up to now. And so each month with the financial reports that that Karen puts into the packet for you, included in that will be a capital project spreadsheet, which will have all of the capital projects, if they're funded, if they're finished, you know, what's going on with them. It'll all be there. It's not a narrative, it's a spreadsheet, but it will at least show you that the project has been voted on, approved, funded, and is in, you know, in this stage or that stage or whatever. And then if it's something specific that you are interested in, if you're interested in the Beach Harden Trail, then you would be able to see that information on the spreadsheet. And then you could ask, you know, at the work session or at the meeting, you know, questions, or you could come into City Hall and ask questions about the status of it. But that's how the treasurer keeps the council informed of what's going on with the projects and things like that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, perfectly. And that's, yeah, I'm looking forward to being able to have to track that and not having to keep track of it myself and letting you do that. And I then glean the information from it. So that sounds great.
Yep. And so I did know about the spreadsheet. I could have put it in the previous month's packet, but when I looked at it, it was so incomplete that I thought it would be better to wait and give you an accurate reporting rather than what was available at the time. So it will be in the packets going forward. Do you have any questions for the treasurer,
recording of this be on the website?
No, the recording I can send to you individually. Okay. It won't be on the website since it's not an actual meeting. There's not really any place to put it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would. I'd like to listen to Ben's report.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. No problem. I can send it. All right, I guess we'll move on to Seoul with the fire department.
All right, let's get the slideshow going. And the slideshow, there is construction going on. So that's probably, I'm not sure, Janine, if you hear it, but they're working on a new awning here at City Hall. But like you all know, I am the fire chief for the fire department. We have where, if you dial 911, we're here to help answer the call and help. And EMS and fire, if you're calling for law enforcement, sorry, can't help you there. We can give you the phone number for the troopers and or call them ourselves, but they would more likely like to hear from the source. But other than that, we stick to fire and EMS calls. Generally that's all our calls we get. So we get a few calls where we have to refer to the troopers, but we're fortunate that it's just EMS and fire. It's a little bit of a history. This building was built in 1986, but it was in the 1980s when it was built. We had our first volunteer fire chief, Larry Tong, when it was being built during time. There was a group of other hard-willing volunteers that I was involved in getting the grants and getting the building built itself. And if I were to name them, I'll probably forget somebody, and I don't want to insult them. So I'll just name Larry Tong because he actually is the one that has the plat hanging on the wall in our building. As of right now, we got paid fire chief. We got two paid COVID testers still. And this year alone, we're actually sitting around 40 calls. We were about 46 calls last year. We're reaching that point this year, but I think we slowed down quite a bit. We had a paid fire chief since, I want to say 2010, 2009, around there. And so far, I think we benefited greatly from having a paid fire chief from before. We were able to got basically a new fire engine, new ambulance, we got new tankers. If anybody's been here longer than 2012, remember the Beast, that thing had ended up got rid of it. It had no brakes, no springs. And it was just danger, and they couldn't go above 20 miles per hour, which for Covioco had no brakes. That's a good thing. So we end up selling on that. I think actually Elm has it still. Either way, we got a relatively new to us tanker one, which is the one I'm sitting, and then tanker two is sitting outside. We'll go further on, but I do honestly believe that it was because we had a PA fire chief sitting in the office, and doing all the paperwork, is because we got those rigs, and so on. We do have a total of 18 volunteers, 8 of which are dispatchers, and then 10 are either just fire or EMS or just both. We don't really force people to do what they don't want to do. If they want to handle people, we can sell, they just fire. We do have we averaging one fire a year. And we do train every Tuesday. And as far as EMS and fire goes, there is certain regulations we have to kind of do, we have to follow. We can't exactly do stuff that is out of a scope just because we're in a small town. So there is EMT, EMT 1, 2, 3 classes that we, if we want to go further on, that's going to take. Work on getting EMT, more EMT 2s. Right now, we're going to send Dean 2 volunteers in February to Juneau to teach. And I'm trying to get myself to have my ETT instructor's license as well. In the end, when the call helps, we don't forget what we can do, but we can think about what we can do even without the certificates. Anybody can do CPR, anybody can drive a rig once they follow our departmental policies and passing the, that and kind of certain stuff. So just because you think, oh, volunteer fire department, you have to have an EMT or firefighter one, stuff like that, that's not true. Anybody can come in and provide some form of help. So I'm basically telling the council, if you're know somebody that's on the edge of wanting to volunteer, just tell them to come on by. We train every Tuesday, so we're always looking for volunteers, whether they want to become a dispatcher, firefighter, or EMS, or kind of dabble in both, all three. Like I said, we have 4 vehicles. Not all of them are on here. Tinker 2 is the one sitting outside and has 2 black stripes on the end. We don't really use that, and I'm getting to a point where we don't use it as we don't, if all possible, just because it's becoming the new beast. It's not doing so well. I'm working on trying to place it, looking for grants to apply for. Don't think there's the AFGA grant I'm looking at applying for, but I have little hope of receiving it, just because of they don't like giving out money to departments that have not much training in the device they're trying to purchase. So I'm looking at other options. They are the AFG grant committee are trying to change that a little bit for next year, so I'm going to be looking into it again next year. We have fire engine that's working great. Does a job for us, and also another water tanker as well that moves water, and then the ambulance, which we take quite a bit. Majority of our calls is actually a fire with EMS, that's the one where we use a lot, and everything so far works and it and all that. We do provide COVID testing still, at least till the end of next fiscal year. We'll probably discuss it when the budget comes along. But we test 3 days a week this winter. It's Monday, Thursday, and Saturday to 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. The 2 tests we do have is antigen and a rapid molecular testing PCR. which is slightly more accurate than the antigen tests. We do we still do provide take-home tests as well. So if you want to come by and grab a take-home test, we can provide you a nice $1 as well. We don't, we do not give out vaccines. Just let you know, if you want to get on the vaccination list, I would call it a search clinic. So yeah, like I said, COVID testing, we also provide medical and fire emergency services. And also I am a certified CPR instructor. So if you want to become a, to get a CPR card, you can give me a call. I'm not the only one as well. We got at least two more other volunteers that also have their CPR instructor's card as well. They're able to teach it as well. Yeah, speaking of search clinic, we're not part of the search clinic, or they're not part of us. However, we do work closely together and calls, depending on what situation is. We may call the provider in if the provider is willing to. If the provider pretty much could say no, and we have to follow that. But but yeah, and generally we do work closely together. The two RNs the two staff there is our volunteers as well. We do help each other when we can. I would like to hope future, like I said, I'm trying to replace our water tender, looking for grants and stuff like that. New water tender can cost $500,000 to $600,000 now. It was like $300,000 to $400,000 last year, but I expect quite a bit of things went up. I still want to develop new plans for a new fire hall. Like I said, I don't think we need a new fire hall in this next like 5 years, but we should develop some plans for in 10 years when we do need a new fire hall, we're ready to build. And also I'm looking to get more EMT1 and EMT2 classes. The EMT2 class actually is coming up in February for two volunteers. EMT1 class is a little bit harder to get, just because a lot of departments have their instructors in department and they do it 3 days a week over a couple months, and asking volunteers to go to a different town for 3 months is not really feasible. So I am working on seeing if I get my ATT instructor license and also become an EMT1 instructor license as well. But that can take a couple of years. And that might help a little bit in basically teaching new volunteers to get their ATT, then they can bridge over to the EMT1. Because the EMT1 is a 3-week class without the ETT, but 2 weeks with the ETT. So, unless you have any questions, let me know. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Sol, and thanks for what you do and for keeping us informed of what's going on with the EMTs and the whole staff and things. So thanks a lot.
No problem.
I think bring up Paul's PowerPoint and we can move into the DRC. This one's Paul's right here.
Asking questions. That's the burden of that role. We have to make decisions based on you have to ask us, or you have to know more than the person who's talking.
Yeah, so as the presenter, like, if you don't get any questions, like, okay, if you want to do this one, you did your presentation so good that like, you don't have any questions, you answer all the questions before they had them, right. Or you're so bad, they can't go formulated question that to know not to answer my guest question.
Right. You have not been asked.
Oh, that's it.
All right, Paul, you can use my computer.
My notes are on this one.
Okay, there you go. You got two screens.
Does this one have a frame?
So you can
advanced?
Just arrow to the next page. All right, thank you, Sol.
Do you need a break or anything, Shelly? Yeah, I've been sweating over this for over 24 hours. So. And is this on or?
It is on. You can tell by that little light on the side there. It's not super obvious.
And are you ready, Janine, or are you?
Go for it.
Another department to. Okay, so I have. And the purpose of this isn't so much to describe the nuts and bolts of the DRC, because I think the both of you know kind of what our mission is as far as solid waste and recycling, and there are a lot of deals to that. Really, the best way to answer those questions is to get a tour for myself or Ian, because that's, you know, that speaks more than pictures and stuff. So my presentation is more about kind of the big things, personnel, my transition, and the three big projects we have and other smaller projects that are out there. So that's kind of what I've, you know, made this presentation all about. And as far as the, because it's the staffing that makes everything at the DRC happen, myself at the top, and then the operator, and then the labor pool. And it's the operator and the labor pool who are doing most of the work. I have a coming retirement with the end of the fiscal year, June 30th. And it would be quite unlikely for the city to seek a new manager. It would make more sense for the operator to transition into the role of the DRC manager. Our facility is too small to have somebody who's just a manager doing those things. That really, you know, the operator manager makes far more sense than hiring someone who's just a manager. And I have been telling whoever cares to know that while I would be retiring from the DRC manager role, I would be available as a temporary employee for any of these projects to help projects go. I just want to be done with managing the DRC and that kind of thing, but I would be available as a temporary employee if the city wants to do that for help with the projects that we're working on or stuff like that. But if you don't need that, that's fine. And I'm always available for questions and everything because, yeah, it's my baby. And also in my role kind of disseminating information and other facilities in the state, really secession and secession planning is kind of the next topic that I'm adding to my things that I talk about, you know, and with the Zender group and go to various communities, because secession is something that every facility has to go through. So I'm taking the lessons from this process and kind of folding it into the overall thing. So, I mean, yeah, it's very interesting in that regard, but really the operations boils down to what happens at the DRC, you know, with trash and recycling and the community chest. That's it. And then I have created a special kind of thing, because one thing a lot of council members want to know is how much capacity do we have? How long is the facility going to last? So I do like to talk about what we call the mound, which is the trash mound that we've been placing our waste in since 1993. Is when the area inside the fence was starting to be used. So it's really has a very remarkably long life, and that is due to aggressive recycling and active management, as opposed to something that people would just throw stuff in at their own time, that thing would have been filled long ago. But with active management
and compaction. It actually has quite a bit of life, and there's not a set height for the mound. So a lot of it is, you know, how long you can use it is determined by what kind of final, you know, it's not like we have a shape that we're projecting out there and you can see how close to it. I mean, you can do that, but that isn't something that I've got. But starting last year, I did do a measurement, I guess it was in May of this year, of measure how much trash was deposited in the last year from that point in time, and then come up with a volume. And so I came up with 255 cubic yards, which was very close to the 250 cubic yards that was mentioned in the closure plan that I'll discuss a little while later, because that's with the mound. But one of the things that I did leave the city with is this 1920 or 2021 landfill planning document that I'll touch a couple of slides. Oh yeah, good idea. You guys aren't even looking at what I've been looking at. Hello. Yeah, and that's me getting stuck. Yeah, that was my realizing that these soils are too soft, and that, yeah, that's a lot of weight and not an easy thing to get out. But yeah, that is one of the challenges, because we take topsoil from various builders for free, but it tends to have a high clay content, which is great for a cap because it sheds water, but it's not so good for a working surface. That actually would be better for pit run and stuff. So, you know, we try to manage it as best we can as far as, you know, getting free soil as opposed to having to pay to transport each cubic yard. But there's a cost for free cover soils. So the next one, that's kind of a picture from this September. Kind of gives you in the, if you look in that area with the white where the cursor is, that has all been placed since December 18th of last year. How long we can use that layer, I'm pretty sure we'll get the full year out of it. Whether or not we get an entire additional year out of it, I'm not quite sure. And then this area in this corner is the construction demolition, which just kind of really depends on how much material people bring in over time as far as how fast that fills. But that's why that kind of, you know, has an open thing, because construction demolition waste is typically not covered with tarps and everything like the other baled stuff. So that's why it's exposed like that, is because it's not an animal attractant. The risk, though, of going up higher and higher is the wind catches your material. And if you have strong winds and a lot of exposed material, you can have a mess. So there is a price and a concern for these area fill mounds, but that is Gustavus's future, is mounding our waste. And then that kind of ties into, so this is the plan, the November 2021 landfill development plan that was done by Vista Geoenvironmental. It's on the city's website on the DRC's page. That document is really your key for being able to get an idea of how much space is available, because the person who put this document together came up with A, B, C, and D. And in each one of those areas, there is a cubic foot, you know, for going up 2 feet or one lift, because that was based on the size of our bales at this point in time, though that would change with a bigger baler, how much capacity you would have on each one of those layers. It doesn't tell you how high you can go. That's really an aesthetic. I mean, you can't go any higher, of course, than something that, you know, is, you know, because you get smaller every time you go up. And that rate of ascension is shown. It's basically for every one unit go up, you come in 3 units. So you end up with a very gradual slope, and that's the most stable of slopes. It doesn't mean you won't have erosion, but that's the most stable a structure, and you're not going to have any collapses. Facilities that use really steep walls run the risk of having sloughing and collapsing. This one, you're not going to have that problem. So that kind of gives you your parameters as far as how much. I can safely say, by looking at the 11.9 acres that the city owns in that area and our present rates of consumption, I mean, I think you're, even with growth, with active management, you know, you're looking at 50 years of capacity. You know, unless something significant happens, if you have a tsunami and people are bringing in their collapsed houses and everything, and you're filling up area D in short order, that would change that. But I think that parcel with aggressive recycling and active management would last this community, I would guess, on the order of 50 years. But that, again, that's active management and stuff like that. But that's, I've just put that in there because I know a lot of time council members want to know how long can we use the site? And my answer to that is we can use it for a long time if we take good care of it and actively manage it and don't put stuff in there that has a better use somewhere else, like metals and stuff like that, things that we can recycle or repurpose. Oh yeah, please, just make sure you get my attention because I keep going and going.
I will, thank you. So when we were looking at the site photo, the one before this, and you were showing us the new refuse. Are those compacted bales we're looking at, those white items?
You're looking underneath that. That's the tarp that covers them. So okay. If we were to lift that, you mm-hmm. would see the individual bales.
Okay.
And, you know, our style has been to do single layers. Other places could do multiple layers and then a cover. But I like using the tarps because then you have to do the least amount. I mean, you don't want to. Yeah, I get into some esoteric things on building and whatnot. But yeah, what you see, the tarps is not the trash because you can't have trash directly exposed because that's what the birds would be hitting. If it's baled, it does a good job of not being prone to the wind blowing it around. That's really one of the nice qualities of bales, is that they keep the trash contained, where if you have a regular landfill that gets a lot of wind, they can actually have quite a bit of distribution by winds. You'll see that in Fairbanks. I saw it in Nevada, you know, places where they typically just put the trash out and then drive the compacting dozers on it. The wind just, and with a mound, you know, your wind exposure. So, I mean, that's the risk, you know, as the higher up you go, the more wind is going to hit it. The birds are always going to be interested in it. The rain is always going to fall on it. But with the tarps, you can manage the ravens and the wind, but, the ravens and the rain, but yeah, with additional height, you do run the risk of that. Did I sufficiently answer your question? Okay. That development plan, which is on the city's website, is a real key document, and it's written in such a way that you can start from ground zero as far as your understanding. It references the state regulations that apply to landfills, tells you where to look in DEC's regulations as far as how much cover material you have to have and stuff like that. It's a very good document for council members and for interested members of the public because it is self-explanatory and it gives a gives backup for how they reach their conclusions. And then projects. And that's kind of what is my big thing now. I will not be seeing the conclusion of these projects as a city employee, but my goal is to get these projects as started as I can and then just be available to help them because these projects are real important to the future of our facility and being able to deal with like currently I'll talk about that when we finally get there, like with the next slide. The main building is undersized for the amount of material that we're processing through it. I mean, on a day like today, this time of year, it actually it's okay. You know, it's not trash isn't flowing out the door and stuff like that. But in the summer of 2019, which is the last super summer, and actually even 2021 with the two projects were happening, that is when you start to get the stress by the amount of use and you start having, you know, stuff flow out the door and not quite enough room inside to work with the machinery and everything. So for where we were, the building was built in 96, 98, where we were at that point in time or where we are in the winter, you know, the building kind of, you know, it has its deficiencies, but in terms of how much space, it sort of approximates it. But in the summer or and with growth of the community, that simply is not large enough building. And then in a construction format, it's not built for having machinery being used inside of it, and it doesn't have enough area to use a larger baler that would be more efficient for us to use in our work. And that ties in with the third project. So this was the conceptual drawings that I put out and ended up with P&D engineers in Juneau to kind of show the drive path. Because as you know, now when you come to the DRC, you kind of drive up and you wait in a queue. Well, that area for that driving up and waiting in a queue is going to disappear because that's going to be where the new building is. So we're having to develop a new area, which is better shown in this diagram here, so that cars coming in can form a queue this way. And if you need, because let's say it's really busy or people are buying compost or whatever it is, you have a long line, you can actually use this access, which is primarily to access, this is where we store our bales of recyclables that are going to be shipped out. This is where you would actually load them. Currently, we load them in this area, but in the future, we would load them in this area. But you can use that longer access. That's why it has this kind of long run to it. So if you are in a situation where you've got a lot of cars queuing, we can keep all of that off of Harbor Road. And so it all stays on city property in this area. Or if there's really no traffic issue, then people can use this shorter link and kind of come right in. And the whole idea with this building design was to not have any backing up so that everybody is staying in a straight line, minimal amount of possibility of people running into things or each other or building posts and stuff like that. So that was the idea with this, is to have flow. And these layout, those are not walls with the different colors and everything. There's actually zero interior walls with this, except for maybe this enclosed little thing here where we would have a kind of, if you were to go into the DRC now, there's the desk and the computer that monitors the scale. That's what this would approximate. And this could also be a warm-up room. I don't see this as a heated room because this is 6,000 square feet. It's quite large. You don't want to heat that. And there's really no reason to heat it. And one of its most expensive features is the floor, which is concrete, 8 inches thick, and this push wall in the back, which is 10 inches thick, or maybe it's 12 inches thick and goes 10 feet high. The amount of concrete in this building is really what makes it expensive. It's got a lot of concrete in it, but it's kind of making the next step in our usage, which I'll go to this one. You can kind of see this push wall here. That this is actually a picture from Juneau's old landfill building. I know we're not on Juneau scale. I mean, we're not looking at that kind of growth, but it's just to give you an idea how this works. Is that instead of having these little bins that you go and then put things in and pick them up and put them in the baler, you push the items into an area. And then when you want to feed the baler, you go up there with your loader bucket, pick them up and drive over to your baler, which has a hopper in it, and dump them in. So that in the time that you're moving a lot of trash, you've got the ability to use machinery to move it rather than having to do it all by hand. So it kind of cuts down on how much labor you need and what kind of labor you're doing. You're basically operating equipment instead of manually doing it. I mean, you still can do things by hand, place things in a hopper by hand, but this kind of option allows you to handle a lot more waste. So it's kind of, you know, taking into account Gustavus's growth as well as being able to do a kind of new style of equipment feeding, the mechanized feeding. So that's what this back wall is about. And I'm not, I mean, this layout, this is just kind of idea conceptual. Until you start working in the building, you're not quite sure how this is all going to go. So that's why I've specified a building without any interior walls so that you can reprogram it easily and you're not building yourself into a scenario that might not happen that way. It might be like, wow, we really need more space for this and less space for that. Something that's got versatility. And in my discussions with the P&D engineers, it's difficult for the building fabricators to do a push wall that's only half the length instead of the full length. Full length is just a much more straightforward thing. But when you see the price tag for this building, a lot of that is these materials such as concrete, because there's so much concrete involved with the thickness of the pad, We look at the foundation here. You've got, you know, these are rather substantial pads at the base of each steel girder that's supporting the roof. You know, so it's got a lot of concrete, and that's where a lot of its expense comes from. Using a prefabricated metal building kind of lowers your labor when you're assembling it. You know, these are a package thing. It's made to just go together. Nothing is really going to have to be fabricated on site. A lot of it, you know, is kind of set up beforehand. But again, it's a lot of concrete. And so that's, and the, just the size of it. So that's where the building's price tag really comes from.
Okay, Paul, can you explain what a push wall is? Is that a modular wall?
It's basically a wall that you can push against, you know, so mm-hmm. it's being able to come up to something and successfully, okay. you know, so you got a bucket and you want to force things into that bucket. If you use an unreinforced wall, you'll just push out your wall. So in the industry, they typically call them push walls. And you'll see in the composting project, I actually have push walls there too. And like where we mix our compost now, we've got those big concrete blocks. That's basically a push wall. And then where we put the bales in the current building, it's a push wall. You know, it's just reinforced by, you know, the bottom plate of the stud wall, getting some more anchors in it into the concrete. You know, it's a gingerly push wall, but it's not like one that, you know, is really made for a piece of equipment. And a good operator doesn't just slam into there and lift it up. I mean, they have rubber tips or they have steel against the thing so they don't destroy their concrete push wall by continually scraping it or something. You know, they still take some delicate usage. It's just that you're able to use machinery to do the collection and the movement as opposed to by hand. So it's kind of the push wall allows you to do kind of a paradigm shift in terms of how you're moving material that you can't do unless you have a push wall. So it just kind of increases your flexibility, but drives up your cost. But it's very hard to retroactively put in a push wall. That makes it real expensive. Thank you for that. So that's that. And yeah, that's, so you can kind of see from this one too, this is our existing building, which we're going to remove, or the plan is to take out that shed roof that covers where we store our plastics. Because we need a building while the new one is being assembled, because it's 6 to 8 months is kind of the forecast for how long it would take them to build this. So it's not like you can, you know, close for a weekend and build a new building. It's, you know, it's going to be a process that's going to be there for half a year or more. So you need the existing building, and then you never have enough covered space. So why not utilize the existing building for something else? Say a heated shop for working on equipment, or heatable shop for working on equipment, or, you know, maybe for kind of retail in the sense of kind of like the yard at the community chest where you have building products and stuff. There might be a certain kind of material that you could do a resale at the DRC, something like that. Or it could be storage for outflow. I don't know. But again, it's kind of flexibility. But you do need a building while you're building your new building. You know, but one of the things that makes the building, the new building expensive is tying into the old building. I mean, it's cheapest if you just go into a place and put in a new structure. It always costs more when you have to build around something. But, you know, I could never figure out a two-phase approach to the new building that would mean you could actually build it right where the original building is. So it's, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages to utilizing the existing building. It's just in my thinking, you know, if it's found to be cheaper, you know, to go some other direction, you know, to build, And plus, you always need covered space. 6,000 square feet seems like a lot, but once you start putting equipment in it and having a dedicated area that people need, you know, to do their sorting and stuff, and your push walls, you know, for collecting and stuff, you know, you can use up space pretty quickly. So it seems like, okay, you know, as long as that building has a good roof and a good foundation, you know, let's just continue to use it. That's kind of the thing. And we could use these concrete blocks. These are the same kind of blocks that are in the food waste composting area. Eco blocks, they're, you know, big Lego blocks. So they're real easy to pick up and move. You know, as long as you have a loader, they have a little thing on them, you can pick them up and move them and reconfigure it. So yeah, the other of the big three, this one, and this one I've been working on, I think it's on its third attempt now. And it gets more expensive and more elaborate each time, but I take advantage of those opportunities to kind of add things that I regretted not having in the first go around. And in the first go around, I didn't have anything to replace or to add more concrete in the area, because I really should have tucked in a picture of our yard before it had all this concrete, because it was really quite muddy and quite fertile. And this is essential. I mean, with Lisa Doherty, who does Juno Compost, she's running into this issue now. And she started out in an area that had really nice shot rock, but now she's using it so much, and she's using food waste and, you know, is doing the same pattern again and again and again, and she's ending up with this rutted situation. So when you're doing something like composting on a set area in our climate, on, you know, our soils, you really need concrete. So this project is in addition to replacing the Quonset with a much more compost-oriented structure, but it's also paving with concrete this area out here, and where it is along the fence, adding a 4-foot high push wall, so that when you're out in the yard, you can actually, you know, because as it is when we're selling, you know, compost, we can't use the bucket to push all the way to the edge and lift up. We have to stop pushing at a certain point and then shovel it for the rest. The other advantage of paving the yard is you have a lot less opportunity for invasive plants to grow right next to your compost. And it's a very expensive way of dealing with invasives, but it's also pretty effective. This kind of is the layout of our yard. It's kind of where we're storing things. And so this pattern here is that push wall. And I would extend it to this. This was kind of, I don't know why I stopped here. The concrete is actually going to stop with the apron for the new compost building. So this wouldn't actually be, but I would extend the push wall. So this whole thing you can use to more easily collect your materials. And you can see here's the push wall of our, this is our current, you know, push wall with the mixing station and stuff. Make sure you didn't miss any notes with that. Okay, so, and also this is the design, you know, that I submitted to P&D engineers, and this is what they've come back with as far as how they would be sloping the concrete, their construction of the push wall. I mean, they're, I didn't put them in here, but you know, they have very careful diagrams that tells you how you're going to construct this push wall. It's not quite as elaborate as the one in the main building. But again, this adds to its expense. Anytime you're using concrete, especially in a rural area like Gustavus, the cost goes up. But yeah, the composting yard project is actually not so bad. So this is an old drawing. From the second time, this is the one that where we tried to do this in 2020, but the price tag came in. We thought it was going to cost $100,000. It came back at $150,000. And I was like, whoa, you know, and it was right as we were going into COVID. So the council was not comfortable in saying, okay, let's just throw an extra $50,000 in it, you know. Now this project, we're looking at about $360,000. This project, the $100,000 or the $150,000 did not include the additional paving in the composting yard. So who knows how much more it would have been. But even this structure, and also this is the original one. These were 10 feet deep bays. I realize now that with the material sloping at the front, you'd actually only have 4 to 6 feet of full height before it starts to slope towards your front. So these would actually be rather small. So in my going to P&D engineers and coming up with this again, I didn't really have any do it. We've extended it. So instead of being 10-foot deep bays, they're 20-foot deep. And each bay basically is where you're placing the compost. It's going in here. And there's aeration provided, these openings in the floor is so you can blow air in. So if you're doing fish waste, which we're talking about doing, or a lot of food waste and odor is a potential issue, your way of dealing with that is to make sure your pile stays aerobic and run a lot of air through it. and your biofilter is basically, you'd be putting wood chips and finished compost, or kind of not really compost, but kind of screen chips or something, basically stuff that has a lot of biological activity, but is not in its initial composting phase, on the top. And that is your biofilter. So you're blowing the air through the compost pile into these, you know, just kind of wood chips, basically. And that is part of your filtration. So you can, if you have really odorful stuff, you can use your biofilter, you know, to kind of help deal with that. And you can't do that unless you've got aeration. And I had thought about just running pipes directly on the ground that you then pull out, which is cheaper. But if you have to do that again and again and again, you're either not going to do it, or you're setting yourself up for a lot of work or things breaking, or, you know, so it's kind of, I went back to the embedded design. And again, that's what makes these projects expensive. They've got a lot of concrete and they've got a lot of stuff going on in the concrete. So yeah, the current forecast for this project is around $380,000. And some of that is the size and some of it is the price of waiting. None of these projects get cheaper over time. They always get more expensive. So there is a cost involved with waiting. I couldn't find a cheaper way of doing it. I thought about using EcoBlocks, just build the whole thing out of EcoBlocks. You're not going to get an engineer stamp on that because your blocks are not considered stationary enough to be something that can have a wall on top of them. You would have to do something that is bolting all of those blocks together, you know, so it's a rigid structure before an engineer will approve of that in construction. So using, you could use EcoBlocks as, you know, dividers on the middle, but in terms of using them for your structure, they're not going to pass muster. We did remove these doors because actually the doors were fairly expensive. So now it's just going to be open and we'll be using the kind of bird mesh that we use currently on our thing to kind of cover it, you know. So I figured out where I could, you know, make it a little cheaper, save $10,000 or $20,000, but still, you know, you got the overall size and concrete. But again, this has a lot of capacity. Five bays, 20 feet deep, is able to handle a lot more material than we're currently doing. You can store other things in there. In the winter, you could store your wood chips so they don't all get frozen together. You know, so you could use it for covered storage in the winter, but it also allows you to be able to do something like fish waste on a scale that, you know, is sizable. Or if we were to get, you know, twice as much food waste as we're getting now. So it is built for a greater capacity than we're currently doing, but our current system doesn't have a really good turning regime where you put the material in there, wait till the temperature drops and then scoop it out, put it in this area, wait till it's that. I've never had a proper turning regime because I don't have a proper facility. The Quonset structure doesn't lend itself to proper turning. This one, you're basically set up so you can turn into the adjacent bay or one of the close by bays. So it's much easier to properly turn your material as it's aging and going through its cycle. And I've also added, there's a cistern back here. So we can, if the piles get too dry, we can use rainwater to remoisten them and stuff like that. So it does have some, you know, frills as far as water collection and stuff like that. But again, it's got a big roof, so it has, you know, expense in terms of that, but I've tried to keep the structure as basic as possible and as low profile as possible, so it's not something that you have to stare at a lot from the main road. This is about the same height as the existing Quonset, which is 16 feet, it may be 18 feet, so it's within 2 feet height-wise, because I do take that into account. There is a lot of concern by adjacent property owners as far as how this place looks. So the third big project, was there any composting questions?
Paul, this is Janine, and I'm just going to put in that, you know, I think that it's important to have the community remember that the reason why we have 50 years left on our the DRC space
is because of the composting in the past as well as the future. And so while the price tag looks really high, it's actually extending the life of our DRC.
No, that's an excellent point. Yeah, it's true. And when you're burying food waste, you have to do a lot more cover material because the birds have a lot more interest in it. And then you don't get any, you know, usable product out of it. Okay. So yeah, the third project is the baler. And this is one of our two balers that we currently use. This is the one that we're hopefully someday getting from the park. It's parked now, but it's basically ours. But it has been in use since 2003. So it has been used pretty hard and it has to be repaired periodically because it's splitting or, you know, some of the welds are giving out or in areas where there's a lot of use. And so this is basically a different style. So instead of being upright, it's horizontal. So they can use more steel when they build the baling chamber. So it can be much more robust and rigid. And this is a hopper that allows you to dump material into it. You know, so if you're using a bucket, you still could by hand dump something in there, but it's really designed so you could be scooping, taking over and dumping. So you could speed up the baling process quite a bit. And dense bales, as I put in all of my planning documents or, you know, quarterly reports, dense bales are really important when it comes to shipping or extending the life of your solid waste mound.
Yeah, that is actually, yeah.
It's super clean around it and it looks like new.
Yeah, I mean, the park didn't use it a lot, yeah. But that's,
yeah.
Ah, you must be the other council member.
Yeah, long
traveling. Excellent. Yeah, no, I can.
Oh, okay. I was like, wait a minute.
And the thing about horizontal balers is they take a lot more area to work because they need a bigger footprint. So that's kind of the whole backside of that new building was set aside for the horizontal baler. You know, so you have adequate room for the machinery to scoop, take over and dump in it, and then for the bale to come out, to collect the bale, take it out. And yeah, there's a lot of subtleties about baler design and stuff, but, you know, I've selected a baler that's designed for a lot of different materials as opposed to one that, you know, they have a specific type of material that they're set up for. But this one is a closed end baler, which is more set up for a variety of materials. And then as far as other inner projects that are important at the community chest, the door on this building is failing. So I'm gonna talk to the gentleman that have been working on this building to see what the cost would be for giving that a better door in the 301 building. And then getting a quote from the gutter folks to replace the gutters in the yard and by the entrance of the of this building so that we can take care of the dripping rain where there's access and stuff. And then I've had issues with the panes falling out of this window. So getting a quote for installing, you know, good windows on the chest. And then the other intermediate project or project that needs to happen is a replacement or upgrade of our monitoring wells, which is, this is monitor well 6. These were put in back in 93. And the ground has risen since that time. And so they're basically going dry and they need to be deeper. And most of the wells that were put in by the community association were not done properly. So I would be having or would specify whoever puts these in. And Glacier Bay Construction can do these wells. It's not like you got to bring in from someone from out of town. Glacier Bay Construction can put in these wells. And there's 4 of them. So it would be upgrading those 4 wells at approximately the same locations, but that serves the city well in the long run. So you can keep collecting data as far as what's going on with the groundwater. But as it is in April, we're no longer able to really sample because the water level is below the bottom of this 10-foot well. Cause I think all they did was get a 10-foot length of sewer pipe and bury it. I mean, it was really crude. No, it's for metals. You can certainly use it for that. But originally it was, yeah, it was all metals. We also, they did turbidity, which I don't know why, conductance, pH, hardness, and then your main heavy metals from mercury, copper, selenium, zinc, all of those guys, which we do on a 3-year rotation. So we measure up gradient 1 year, down gradient the next year, take a year off, up gradient, down gradient, and you kind of mix it around. So you're sampling at a high, you're sampling in the fall on this set. So you've got more groundwater. Then you're sampling in the spring at a low tide event, so you got less groundwater. So you kind of mix it up. So you're sampling each set at a low water situation and then a high water situation, which we've got written out. I can't really remember it, but it's on a kind of a 3-year rotation. And we do our own sampling here, and I've been working with Ian on that. So that, you know, it's not a super big expense, but yeah, you'd need good test wells in order to get stuff. And yeah, I didn't really have anything for this. This is just a placeholder, but if you need me to wrap up, I can, although I will say for 2024 is a even year. So if the council is into funding a hazardous waste collection event, that would be in 2024. And this last go around, first time we did it, it was like 18,000. The last go around was 36,000. So you can see their costs have definitely, and we got about the same amount of material, but that would be something that would need to be planned in 2024 if that's something the council is going to, you know, decide that, yes, we have enough funds to do this, to spend, I would probably budget 40,000 or 45,000. I mean, it should reach some stability there, but yeah. But that would be a factor in 2024 if the city wants to stay in that same schedule. Yeah. That's any of you guys got any questions? Yeah. Karen has that, so. Thank you. No, I appreciate it. I love flapping my lips.
All right. And do we need to take a 5-minute break to go to the bathroom or anything? Janine, how are you doing?
Hey, I never passed up a chance to do that. So sure, let's take a 5-minute break.
Let's do 5 real quick.
This is just one. They're not on the TV show. It has the layout of the map. That's what I think about. Mm-hmm. Wow. It's on the certain place.
It's hard, it's one of those scenarios where I don't know what it's going to be, but you go over procedure.
This one basically has different areas, and then he's got capacity, each one of these areas for the right.
Well, you guys are welcome to stay for my riveting presentation or not. you're welcome to stay or go. You don't have to. These three have to stay. All right. Janine, are you back?
Perfect timing. I just plugged my ears in again.
Awesome. So I did cut a few things out of my presentation because I noticed they're going to be covered tomorrow in the newly elected online thing. So I'm just going to dive right in and try to be done before the librarians show up. So I started in 2017, part-time, although during the winter I'm working a little more hours than I would normally work in the summertime. I work at the pleasure of the city council and receive my direction from the city administrator. I'm a public notary, I'm a certified parliamentarian, and I'm also a certified municipal clerk since 2019. And slowly but surely, I've been working on becoming a certified public information officer so that I can assist with incident command stuff. And you can find a more detailed list of my responsibilities on the website and my job description, but my main responsibilities are here on the right. Basically, anything and everything having to do with the meetings is my responsibility. I provide administrative support to the city departments and city council members. I'm also responsible for all of your onboarding as council members, and I do that for some of our other departments as well. I'm responsible for the website, the news group, email, bulletin boards, and all the social media stuff, which is pretty limited. All the public relations between the city and the community. I post all of our meeting notices, public safety announcements, ordinances, and resolutions. I serve as the city elections registrar, and I'm responsible for calling and supervising all city elections. And I also do all the early absentee voting for all elections. And that always happens over here at City Hall for that. I manage all the city records and archiving, and also the destruction of records according to a retention schedule, and public records requests. And then of course I staff City Hall during the business hours. For the most part, if I'm not here, somebody else like Ben or Kathy would be answering the phones, but I'm kind of the person that fields all the in-person phone calls and emails. Let's see here. So meetings, I'm just gonna talk a little bit about our meetings. Our regular meetings that we have is our regular work session. That's always the first Monday of every month. And then our general meetings, which is always the second Monday of every month, except for if there's a holiday, they would get pushed back a week. And in this case, Thursday, December 1st, we've moved the work session up a week or a few days because of most of us being gone. We have special meetings, emergency meetings, and executive sessions. Special meetings, there's different rules for noticing for the different types of meetings. Special meetings, we'll usually try to notice 5 days in advance, but at the very least, it's 24 hours notice that we need to notice that meeting, a special meeting. A special meeting can be called by the mayor or two council members. Emergency meetings, they are also known as special meetings called, but they can be with less than 24 hours notice. And that would be something that is of an urgency that it would need to be held right away. There's other work sessions, and So we have our regular work session for the first Monday of every month, but other work sessions can be added as needed. And those would need to be noticed 5 days in advance. No official action can be taken at work sessions. All work sessions are open to the public, but no public comment is usually taken at work sessions, unless, of course, the mayor invites that. And then the other meeting that we have that I just threw in there at the last minute are town halls. And this would be something where, you know, there's something that the council wants more community involvement in. And an example of that would be like the beach cooperative management plan. We had a lot of town halls regarding that because we wanted to get as much public input as possible. That was a big deal for our community. Executive sessions, they haven't happened too much in the last few years. In the beginning, there was quite a few executive sessions for me since I started in 2017. But these executive sessions are not open to the public and they can only be called for certain reasons. One of which would be if there were adverse financial consequences for the city. Maybe somebody's reputation or character could be compromised and we would want to do that behind closed doors. If that were the case, the person involved would need to be notified and they may request that that part of the meeting take place in an open meeting rather than an executive session. Certain matters that it need to be kept confidential and of course, attorney-client privilege. The thing with executive sessions is that you can't just have an executive session. You have to, it has to start out as a public meeting, which would either be a special meeting or a general meeting. And then a motion would be made to go into executive session. And so there's certain rules that need to be followed for that. And then of course, no action can be taken in an executive session. So you would need to come out of executive session, the meeting would become public again. And then if there was any action that needed to be taken, a motion would be made, seconded, and then it would be voted on. For agendas, the agendas are set, approved by the mayor. It's the mayor's agenda. Usually what happens is I'm building meetings all the time. You know, I'm always preparing for the next meeting. So maybe there was a ordinance that was introduced the previous meeting. I'm already plugging it in for a public hearing on the next meeting. I'm already plugging in minutes that need to be approved. So I'm kind of managing agendas from month to month and year to year even. There's things that happen annually. And so I have kind of the base agenda, and then anything that is added to that, maybe the mayor has things that he needs to add, or one of you as council members wants to add something to the agenda, then you would go through the mayor, and then I would get those from the mayor, and I build the agenda, and they get approved by him. Request for agenda items, they should go through the mayor. It's always a good idea to CC me on, you know, things like that, especially because then I have it on my radar and I'm thinking ahead. Deadlines for agenda items and packet documents are 10 a.m. 5 days prior to the meeting. And I have to have it by then. It will make me absolutely crazy if I don't, because I have a deadline that I have to meet. So 10 a.m. is a super generous deadline. Then it gives me 2 hours to do everything that I need to do to notice that meeting and have the packet together. It's easier for me to change things for a general meeting than it is for a work session. So if it doesn't make the packet, it doesn't go in, or I get really, really frustrated and nobody likes me. it's just really hard to change things after the fact. But it's also hard, you know, if you don't meet the deadline, it doesn't get in the packet, then it gets emailed out separately to the council members. And that I feel like is overwhelming to you as council members, because then you have all these additional emails and all these additional things that you kind of have to put back together for this one meeting. And it feels like there's just a lot of loose ends that way. And then you don't have all the tools that you need to make informed decisions. So 10 a.m., 5 days prior to the meeting. So it's always, you know, the Wednesday before, basically, for those Monday meetings, which is usually the meetings that I'm talking about here, are the work session and the general meetings. So it's always 10 a.m. the Wednesday before the work session, 10 a.m. the Wednesday before the general meeting. The order of business is in our ordinance. And then there's an opportunity for the mayor to request or make any changes to the agenda as item number 4. And that would be maybe moving things around the agenda or removing something from the agenda, but we don't add things to the agenda. We can take things off, we can move, rearrange the order of business, but we cannot take things, we cannot add things to the agenda. And I just wanted to go through these agenda items real quick. We have the approval minutes, which is routine, the agenda changes, the committee and staff reports. We don't really have any committees anymore, but this title is still the same because it is in our ordinance. And sometimes we'll have special presentations that we'll plug in here to committee and staff reports. There's lots of opportunity for public comment. There's one at the beginning, and this is just for non-agenda items. The consent agenda is used for things that you know, are routine, something that there was not a lot of opposition to that we don't expect, just to kind of move things so that you can process a meeting a little bit faster. Certificate of records destruction, you will see on here oftentimes. When I have slow periods, I'll work on records. And then NCOs, the introduction of NCOs can go under the consent agenda, but the public hearing can't. So you'll oftentimes see most NCOs will be found on the consent agenda. Unless it's something, you know, big that maybe the council needs a little more discussion on, I might have that under new business so that you can talk about it. Or maybe I'm expecting an amendment to an NCO, then I would put it under new business. Scoping documents will oftentimes go under the consent agenda. Unless, of course, I feel like, or the mayor feels like there needs to be more discussion on it, then it'll go under new business. Let's see here. Ordinance for public hearing. We'll have NCOs, non-code ordinances, and regular ordinances here after they've been introduced. And you can kind of tell, like this first one, FY2307, you can see that that's a code change. That's our code of ordinance. That's our laws that we live by. And then NCOs and non-code ordinance, those are have to do with finances, moving money around. Unfinished business, let's say a meeting went on past 10 o'clock and nobody wanted to extend the rules to go longer. But we still had unfinished business, I would move that to unfinished business for the next meeting. And then new business, you'll always see resolutions under new business. So CY2223, that is a resolution. Resolutions are done numbered by current fiscal year, CY22. Ordinances and code, non-code ordinances are all done by fiscal year. By current year, so that's why they're always labeled CY22. And then ordinances and non-code ordinances, they're all done by fiscal year. Yeah. Resolutions, you'll always see under new business, because in ordinance, it says that we actually have to read the resolution out loud. So we'll always put that under new business. If you ever see me put one in consent agenda by accident, let me know, because they can't be under consent agenda. Then we've got council reports. Mostly this ends up just being the mayor most recently, but maybe you have a special project that you would want to report on. I hope to be doing some work with Brian, you know, and Janine maybe with our website and different projects, you know. So if you have a special project that you want to report on, it would go under city council reports. And it's really hard to keep city council and reports separate from city council questions and comments. So basically, if you are working on a special project that you're responsible for, you would report under it, report on it under city council reports. If you have any other questions or comments, it would go under council questions and comments. Oftentimes these two blend together and I have to kind of figure out where they separate in the minutes. And then again, another opportunity for public comment on non-agenda items. One thing that I forgot to mention under, you know, items that you're voting on, the process that we use here is that the mayor announces the agenda item, there's a motion, a second, and then there's always public comment on any of those agenda items that you're voting on. And then it goes to council comment and then a vote. So the public gets to comment on non-agenda items and then also any action agenda item. They don't get to comment at like committee staff reports or, you know, council reports. It's only under items that you're voting on. And then we have executive session on here as an agenda item. But we haven't had any executive session for a while. Looks like I got 15 minutes left. Email, use your city email only for city business. Don't use your personal email. Sometimes it can happen accidentally, but if you're using your personal, you shouldn't be using your personal email for any city business. Do not use, send emails to the entire council. So if you have something that you want all the council to know about, something amazing, some important information you want all the council to know about, send it to me and then I will send it out to the council blind copied. You can't be corresponding with all the council members because that would be considered a meeting and that would violate the Open Meetings Act. And you guys are gonna learn more about that tomorrow in the newly elected officials training. Don't delete any of your email. I need that for my records, for archiving. But if you would organize your email in folders, you know, once you've read it, you know, maybe organize it by subject matter or, you know, like I've got a folder going right now for AML. You guys are going to the AML concert. So I have everything in AML there. I have folders for the inner tie, the treasurer, council, general meetings, ordinances, like they're all organized scoping documents, departments. So if you guys, I don't really care how you organize it, but subject by subject matter might be the easiest.
Yeah, so I've been deleting news except when it comes, unless it's something that the department has sent out. Mm-hmm. A lot of library news items, and I didn't post. Or if I get things that are just a sort of commercial
advertisements or so newsletters. Yeah. I mean, it's easier for me just to tell you to save everything than it is to tell you what not to, what is okay to save and what isn't okay to save. Yeah. Yeah. But I think that's fine. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, if you're sending, it's kind of also hard to decide what you would want to include me on as a clerk or not. But oftentimes when I'm sending emails, I'm including the mayor and the city administrator, you know, just to keep us in the loop, but also keep me in the loop too, because I'm the one that's fielding all the phone calls and all the people and like organizing everything behind the scenes. So it's really helpful for me to be, you know, sometimes I'm just skimming it or whatever, like my inbox gets blown up like crazy. And so a few more emails is gonna be more helpful than not, probably. So just feel free to CC me on most emails that you're sending out to the mayor and the city administrator. Social media, we've got three social media sites. They're all Facebook. We have one for the city, basically stuff that I send out. We have an emergency operations center one that isn't really in use right now since we don't have an emergency happening. And then the library has one, and they get a lot of use out of theirs. As council members, city business should be conducted through city outlets only. So if you're on your personal Facebook page, and you shouldn't be commenting on city stuff, related stuff, basically. If you feel like you really just can't hold yourself back from commenting, you need to declare that you're doing so, you know, not as a council member. Okay. And I'm not on the rumor mill. I'm not on any of those pages anymore because I just couldn't stand it. apparently there's not much happening anymore. That's, you know, super egg or anything, but I just didn't want any part of it. I didn't want to see it. And it was really hard for me to keep my mouth shut. So I just don't do those pages anymore. And I miss out on a lot of fun stuff by not, but that's how I've dealt with it. Let's see, how many more slides do I have? Records retention. I'm just gonna touch on this briefly. We do have a records retention schedule that I updated recently. It'll probably get updated again, but that I follow, but it hadn't been followed, I think, maybe just barely. Well, Shelley was here when I first started in 2017 volunteering, and we had hundreds of boxes that we went through. And so I have been, for the last 5 years, been going through these boxes in the beginning with the help of Shelley and Karen Taylor. And so it's something that I continue to do as I have time. I've gone through most of the city hall records, paper records, and starting to work with the different departments with their paper records and then there's the electronic records. So it's kind of a beast. And you'll see a records destruction certificate on the consent agenda, like I mentioned before, quite often. And a lot of the records that we have actually date back pre-city, and those I have also included on that certificate when I destroy them. But it's kind of cool because we have a lot of records that provide a historical perspective from pre-city here. So they've been pretty fun to go through. And basically everything's a record. Just don't destroy anything. Anything that you're working on as a council member, I wanna keep. I wanna be the one to delete it. So I can make sure that we're following that records retention schedule. The librarians just walked in, hi. So I'm just gonna try to go through these really quickly. Resolutions, in case you don't know, they're defined as a formal expression of an opinion, intention, or decision by an official body. They're introduced in writing and orally read before a vote is taken in the same meeting. So they are introduced and adopted in the same meeting, and they become effective upon adoption. They're maintained and archived as a permanent record. And as I said before, they're labeled by the current year. Ordinances are defined as an authoritative law, decree, or municipal regulation. And there are three different ordinances. There's code, which is permanent in nature and in effect over time, establishes rules of conduct to be codified, and they're labeled by the fiscal year. These, excuse me. These types of codes will always be under new business. Non-code, they're not permanent in nature, they're a specific moment in time. They won't be codified. And they're also labeled by the fiscal year and then NCO, non-code ordinance. And I'll try to put these as much as possible. Always under, I can't even read that. Always under, as much as possible, I'll try to put non-code ordinance introductions under the consent agenda, and then it'll be on the public hearing at the next meeting. And then emergency ordinances, they're a form of non-code ordinance. They're usually unusual. It would only be under extreme circumstances. And they are only for 60 days or less. And there's no public hearing on emergency non-code ordinances.
So no notice?
No, because it'd be in an emergency. So that would, you know, probably happen at an emergency meeting. Yeah. Yeah. Ordinance, the process is it's introduced at one meeting, and it has to be posted for a minimum of 5 days. Usually we try to post it 1 month, and then we'll leave it posted for a whole month, and it'll have a public hearing at the next month's general meeting. And that's at the public hearing is when it can be amended and adopted or not. And these are also maintained as a permanent record, and they will be codified into our municipal code. Makes it official. Policy and just procedures. These come from our ordinance code of ordinances, but they're passed by resolution. And we all know what policies and procedures are. So if we want to update a policy and procedure, we'll be basing it off of code and writing a resolution for it to be adopted by. And then, our relationship, we work really closely together with a lot of our duties. So we'll spend a lot of time together. If you have any questions about meetings or Robert's rules or anything that we've already covered, you know, I can help with those things. But it's really important to remember that staff takes their direction from the city administrator. So just keep that in mind. And that the deadlines that I have set in place are really important to me. And it is also really important that you give yourself enough time to read the packets before the meeting. They get sent out on Wednesdays for the work session and the general meeting, the Wednesday prior to the meeting. If at all humanly possible, you know, try to read them before the end of business day on Friday so that we have time to answer your questions, help you develop amendments or understand the finances or whatever it is that you're looking at. It's really nice to be able to do that before Monday, and especially before the meeting on Monday. Because you guys are voting on really making decisions and things that affect our community. And so I want to make sure that you have the tools you need to make informed decisions. That's my job. You know, there's always ways to improve things. I feel like I've done a lot in the 5 years that I've been in this position. And I know there's lots more that I can do that I want to do already. And there's lots that I can learn from each of you. And so I'm really excited to work with each of you and learn from all of you as well. I wanted to take some time. Could I have like 5 or 10 more minutes? I wanted to just do a little two. I wanted to just do a little website tour because it seems like there's a lot of it's hard to find where things are. And so I just wanted to maybe do a little bit of that. So to go to the homepage, you just hit the strawberry. It'll take you back to the landing page there. And there's not a lot under announcements. This is all we have under announcements. To see more, you would hit view all, but I know for a fact this is all I have on there. And then upcoming meetings, let's see. That's a little, there's a little delay on the screen there for you, Janine. Is it not gonna show it? Well, for upcoming meetings, there we go. View all meetings. Right now it's just showing the next 3 upcoming meetings. But if you view all meetings, you can get, you know, all the way from back to 6/6/2022. Sorry, Janine. I've got the agenda, the packet, the minutes, and the recording. There's a few recordings missing because maybe I forgot to hit record or something. We don't take minutes for regular work sessions. And I have not posted the general meeting for December 12th yet. That'll be up there next Wednesday. And then you can do a search for meetings here. There's lots of ways to find old meetings. This isn't the only page that you can find meeting information on. City departments. We've got, you know, all our city departments. Most of the pages are organized the same way currently. On the left, these are not super consistent, but I'm working on that. There's also a calendar on each of the administrative pages here on the left, and then what's coming up just above that. I've got the strategic plan, our really old, outdated strategic plan, hint, hint, capital improvement plan, the beach cooperative management plan that was requested to be on there. We've got last year's budget, this year's budget, our latest accountant review services for 2018, the last year's reports for the city administrator and the city hall staff. And then our position descriptions, and each department has their position descriptions on their page. You can also find, you know, our contact information, staff directory, hours, and then the organizational chart. Government, this is probably where you're gonna spend most of your time. There's each of the council members and their terms are listed here with your contact information, and I've just put your emails there, not your phone numbers. And then here, this is a calendar that I recently added that Janine had requested. So this is gonna take you to just city council stuff. So if you can't remember when your meeting is, and this is only going to be public meetings, not our little meeting today or tomorrow, your training or anything, this is public. So all your meetings here, and then also the deadline for the agenda packets. And this came up as an issue because somebody had misunderstood, from the public had misunderstood the packet. So we decided that was a good idea to have on there, that deadline. All our resolutions can be found at this drop-down menu. Ordinances, this will take you to the Municode codified ordinances. The non-code ordinances, this actually has both of them, the documents that you guys have passed in the meetings. And here you can see like these top three, they have not been adopted yet. These were introduced at the last meeting on December 12th. If they are adopted, they'll have a date when they were adopted next to it. So you can see which ones have been adopted and which ones haven't. Policy and procedure. These are all, like I said earlier, they're based off of ordinance, so I have them organized that way. So any policies and procedures that we have having to do with administration are in this section. Anything having to do with Title III personnel, it would be in this section. Revenue and finance, Title IV, it's in this section. And we don't have any policies and procedures for elections. It's all in ordinance. And so on. And then community, there's a, you know, anything community related is here that I could think of. And then forms, all of, you know, ambulance subscription, vessel registration, business permits, and so on is all here. If you have questions about the website, if you can't find something, just shoot me an email, give me a phone call, and I can help you find what you're looking for. That's it. If you're looking for code, this one is actually a really great website, I think. So anything that was passed recently, you can find here that hasn't yet been codified. And we have recently passed a few of them. And they're currently in the process of being codified. Once they are, so this one here, FY2307, is Title VI. Once it is codified, you'll be able to find it over here on this side in Title VI. But the search is really good for finding anything. So I imagine you guys will spend a lot of time here and in our policy and procedures. And if you haven't yet, you should. You should become familiar with it. That's all I have. If you have any questions.
Is there a link to the city's Facebook page?
No.
That's a great idea.
There's not. I think there is actually, yeah. Okay. Janine, did you have any questions?
No, that all sounds good.
Okay. All right, ladies, I'm going to bring up yours. And then you can have. Sorry. Go away.
I'm going to need to step out of
class. I think we're going to try to finish by then. You guys are last. Yeah. Yeah. Three.
Some of us forgot, and some of us came in.
It's okay. It's totally like, yeah, informal, just us getting together and sharing some stuff. So yeah, I went about 5 minutes longer than I had planned, but if we could be done by 5:30, yeah.
You're so much better than me. I didn't bring any snacks or anything.
No snacks. I'm out of here.
I know. I'm starving.
Are you too good? Do you need a break? No.
Oh, okay, yeah. Make yourself comfortable.
Well, I'm Leanne Weichel, the Library Services Director. I know I've met both of you. And hello, Janine. I can't see where you are, but I know you're here somewhere.
Hey, hello.
Are you in Mexico?
Yes, I am.
It is freezing cold here. Be glad you're not here. I want to bring the new board's attention to is our mission statement, because we live and breathe by it. It's very carefully crafted and founded, and it supports all the work that we do. So I'll give you a second just to read that. It's probably more meaningful if you read it for yourself. Can you see? I'll read it. You're going to get the PowerPoint? All right. The second thing that's really, really important on this slide is the bottom half of it. And it says, a part of the mission is that the Gustavus Public Library volunteers are a foundation. And that has always been true in Gustavus, continues to be true, and we support it being true into the future. So the names that I want to read are important, because these are our current weekly desk sitting volunteers. That means these volunteers come every week, as sometimes twice a week, to volunteer, and they do that day in and day out unless they're out of town, and then they really work hard together to support each other and sub for each other and find replacements. So these names are super, super valuable to Jesse and I. It's Julie Howell, Shelley Owen, Bonnie Harris, Carolyn Elder, Jay Capella, Kathy Hawker, Amy Yeoman, Amy Erfling, Vicky Bender, Betty Hansen, Meadowbrook, and Nina Zarate. Did I say her name right? These volunteers truly are the heart and soul of the Gustavus Public Library, and we want to say their name whenever we can and give them a little bit of acknowledgement. Without them, the next slide shows the staff, what we do couldn't happen. We have big jobs, but it takes those volunteers to make our jobs possible. This is our current staff minus John. He did not want his picture. So it's Jesse Soder, our library administrative director, myself, and then Melissa Gomes. She's a temporary assistant. She's been working to catalog the library and achieve some of our other goals that Jesse will go into in a little bit, that are really, really helping to improve services for our patrons that we're pretty excited about. This slide is a picture of myself. I have a part-time position up to 30 hours a week. And the duties outlined on here that I'll let you read when you get the presentations are pretty encompassing. A lot of my job overlaps with Jesse's job, and we work collaboratively on many, many things. And then I have some very specific things, and she has some very specific things that she does. The important thing is that between the two jobs, we accomplish the work of the library the best we can. And the biggest work of the library is to make it available for learning and information for the citizens of Gustavus of all ages. And that's a term I take to heart, from birth, what's the end of that saying? Birth to, from cradle to grave. And it's important, and we love it. And if you have any questions about each bulleted thing, please let me know. I'm always open to sharing and telling you more about what we do. The part I love of my job the most is the services, meaning I get to interact with the people, story time, putting together Worldwide Knitting Day, right, Janine? Right now, one of my big passions you've all heard me speak about is the SLED, helping the students get on live homework help, helping people find the information we want. So I could go on and on, but I'll stop myself, because our goal is to get you out of here at 5:30. We thought about highlights and accomplishments and have
put them in from a year ago. We did this presentation for the new city council a year ago. And so thought about what are new highlights and accomplishments. And we've completed our story walk trail and have featured several books. The Hammock Reading Forest is ready to go for its grand opening in the spring. We've hosted many library literacy camp. We hosted our first library literacy camp, which was awesome. It was a week long of having students doing outdoor learning and learning literacy. And they had every day daily reading time and they begged for it. It was very rewarding. We built a strong partnership with the Gustavus Community Center and have co-hosted several events together. We're working to build a stronger partnership with the Gustavus School and the Gustavus homeschooling community. We've purchased over 100 items that patrons have requested since January 2022. It's not a very well-kept secret that Jesse and I really would prefer to spend our materials money on what Gustavus wants. And so we very avidly and openly accept requests. If you have an author you love, if there are certain things you think should be in the library, if we think you're the only reader who will want that information, we'll use our interlibrary loan capabilities to get that for you. If we think it's something that will appeal to the broader base of Gustavus, we try to order it for the library. And we have a formula that we work through. Over 1,500 digital items have been checked out through the Gustavus Library through our Alaska Digital Library. And that has increased in a year from 1,000 items to 1,500, which is 50% increase. We're pretty proud of that because we've been working to do that. We've been working to let people know that it exists. We've been working to make sure the Gustavus patrons have access to the library through the e-library services. Currently, we've been offering an after-school art club and reading club, and we're continuing our curbside services and appointments long past COVID because we found out it's something that patrons want to need for a variety of reasons. And then since January of 2022, we've added about 1,700 new items to our collection. The next thing I would like to talk about is programming. There's bits and bobbles in these pictures and in these statements of a whole host of variety of programming that we continue to do at the library. We still do grab and go kits. They're not done monthly any longer. They're done about once a quarter because we've been able to move from having the library only open to curbside and appointments to being fully open since COVID. And we've been adding many, many, many other services. We work in collaboration with the Gustavus School. We have a variety of ways that we're supporting their mission, and we continue to hope to be strong stakeholders in providing services for all ages in Gustavus. We support the Battle of the Books, K-2, that's for pleasure reading in class. We do a weekly preschool story time. The K-1 class has been coming through for weekly visits. That's paused right now. We're working with the second through fifth grade class to set up a time that works for them for class visits. Both of those always hold a literacy component because Jesse and I are both licensed teachers. So it's something that we can easily do and have the skill set for supporting. Others are the SLED, the databases, and any research the high school and middle school is doing. Right now, the high school is in the middle of some reports, so they came over and we helped them find whatever books we had. And then we're also use our interlibrary loan services to get books that we don't have but can access. So that's been awesome. We've had two author visits. Linda Buckley came and both worked with each grade level, teaching them what it's like to be an author, helping them understand her process because she has a pretty strong background in science. Also, she was once a teacher, and how she took her knowledge of science and her love of the topic and put it into a picture book and then became a published author. Paul Gracie has a similar story. He is a teacher. He worked with struggling readers and writers and started writing. And then his wife, who actually has a degree in creative writing, said, "Hey, your stories are pretty good. You should try to publish them." And so both of them also provided some awesome night programs for us. Paul did, and also Linda Buckley, who did a workshop in how to be a self-published author, which was nice. We also have had, because there's been such a growth and inclusion of homeschool we had a homeschool fair last September and invited all the homeschool families that we were aware of in to come in and did a morning of saying, here's all the ways the library supports the Gustavus School. Many of these same ways we can support you in your homeschooling journey. So in other ways that you specifically need as a homeschooler. We've had an egg hunt, which was big and fun. The wrong way. I'm pushing the wrong button here. What am I doing here? I want to go to the next slide. Something's not pushing. Programming for all ages, so should be down there. Is that it? All right. Okay, I'm going to try and finish my next two slides in 2 minutes. We support the Gustavus Book Club for adults. We work in collaboration with the GCC. Halloween, of course, is big. We hosted a spooky read where Jesse and I read spooky stories around the campfire, and that kicked off that month's story walk. And families could go read the story walk. The Everybody Library Band is recently back. This winter, we're kicking off Puzzle Club. We're continuing to work on our Books for Babes and 1,000 Books Before K. I've already talked about SLED and Art Club and Knit in Public. And I'm going to leave you with the final words on that slide and much, much more. Jesse.
Hi, Janine. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you great.
And Brian, I don't think I've met you before. It's good to put a face to the voice because I've heard you at meetings quite a bit. And Shelley, of course. So I'm actually going to start with a slide that's all about Melissa Gome, who is our library assistant. And she is currently working to help us organize our catalog, I guess. And so if you look at the spine labels on the books that are up there, if you can see them, you'll see that they have different labels. You see J/F, you see JUV, you see J, and I'm looking at the letters at the tops of the labels, and they are all labeled differently. And so what she is doing is she is trying to make the labeling and the catalog in the library consistent so that patrons can find books easier, or volunteers can find books easier, and we can find books easier. And so all of those books should be labeled one consistent way. It should be a J/F with the author's last name underneath. And there are inconsistencies like that throughout our library, although there are several sections that she has finished, which are now consistent and organized. She's on her second contract. She had one contract, finished that one, and we asked for money to be set aside in our budget to renew her contract, and it was approved. And so she's on her second contract, and her contract is about 520 hours. And so she works about 25 hours a week, and she often works during closed hours so that she's got the library to herself and it's quiet. And on this slide, and you can read it later, those are goals that Leanne and I sat down with her at the beginning of her first contract. Those were goals for her position. And she's working her way through those goals and has actually completed some of them. So like Leanne said, we have duties that overlap, but then we also have things that we are solely responsible for. A lot of my work involves ordering materials, cataloging materials, keeping track of our budget, reports, submitting reports. We collaborate on grant writing. And one thing that isn't listed here that wasn't necessarily something that I was responsible for was programming, which it's been really great to have an opportunity to do that, to jump in and you know, run art club with kids and work with Leanne during our literacy camp. It's been really fun to jump into those teaching roles, which is one of the things I enjoy the most about the job. The next slide shows our website, and I'm glad that Karen brought you to the website at the end of her presentation. This shows the library section, and I've got a big red arrow pointing at our policies and procedures. Whenever Leanne and I are making decisions, talking about trying something new, we refer to our policies and procedures, and I always go to the website to look them up. It's the easiest, straightforward way. It's always updated. And we recently changed a couple policies in August, I think it was, beginning of August. One policy that we worked on was our children's use policy, and changes we made to that one included allowing adults, their guardians, to sign a waiver in order for children to be left at the library under our supervision so that we could run our day camps. And another part of the policy that we changed was notifying parents if children were disruptive in the library, unsupervised children were disruptive in the library, we could contact parents. There's a few other things in there that we changed as well. And we also updated our collections policy. Part of our collections policy is also covers challenged materials. And so in the news, you've probably been hearing about people challenging materials in libraries. Banning books is maybe a more commonly used term. Just recently in the last week or so, Homer's been in the news because a bunch of people have signed petitions to ban materials that are in their public library. And so Leanne and I really wanted to make sure that our challenge process was clear and concise so that if it happened here, if somebody wanted to challenge something in the library that they didn't think should be in there, we had a policy that we could follow. That we felt would work the way it was intended. And so that's one that we recently updated as well. But definitely take a look at the policies or procedures if you've got any questions about what's going on in the library. Also along the blue menu along the side, there's a link to our online catalog, a link that talks about interlibrary loans, a link to quarterly reports, a link to a page that explains how to access ebooks, and our library calendar. So it's all in there. It's a great place to find information about the library. So how do we get materials into the hands of our patrons? There's kind of three main ways. The first way is we can purchase the item for our collection. And as Leanne mentioned, we love getting requests for materials. We want to buy things that people want. So we try to purchase things that people request as long as it follows our collection development policy. If it is an item that is a little more perhaps obscure or maybe not a lot of people would read it, we might try interlibrary loan. And that program is through Anchorage. And so we contact a librarian in Anchorage who tries to fill that request in Anchorage. And if she can't fill it in Anchorage and send it to us, she'll send the request out and try to fill it with libraries in Alaska. If it can't be filled in Alaska, then it goes a little further and we do get some materials that are shipped from the lower 48. Another way we can get materials in the hands of patrons, of course, is the Alaska Digital Library. There's thousands of books and thousands of ebooks and thousands of audiobooks available through the Alaska Digital Library. So three main ways that we can get materials into our patrons' hands when they're asking for certain things. A big part of my job is managing grants, and Leanne and I overlap with this. And Right now we have three grants we're either working through or have just worked through. The top one is the PLA grant. That's the Public Library Assistant Grant. That's state funding. And that can be up to $7,000. And you can ask for up to $7,000. And we do, we ask for $7,000 a year. And we have to meet certain requirements with the hours that we're open. We have to have evening hours and be open a certain number of hours. We have to offer children's programming, offer ILL services in order to qualify for that grant. And so we receive that grant every year. And we have to spend at least half of it on library materials, which would be books, DVDs, could be games or puzzles, anything like that that would circulate in our library. And we spend the entire $7,000 on materials, even though we are only required to spend half of it. We spend all of it. And we get that grant each year. The second grant listed there is the Alaska Community Foundation's grant. And that grant, I didn't put the amount up there, but that one was for $10,000. And the funding from that is privately, it's privately funded. Leanne applied for that and was awarded that last April. And that is the grant that is funding our day camps. And so we've run one literacy camp so far. That was last August, and we have plans for more. And then the last grant listed on there is the ARPA grant, and that was federal funding through the American Rescue Plans Act. And it had to address some need in the community that to respond to COVID, like some need that was created from COVID. And so we came up with a couple of ideas for that. That grant was for about $6,000. And the two ideas that we, the two things that we funded with that was our story walk trail and our STEM kits that can be checked out. And the idea was that if patrons can't come into the library, they can like take things out of the library, take them in their home and use them, or be outside and walk the story walk and read a book while they're outside. So I've got some slides coming up next that show those projects. The ARPA grant has ended. The final report for that was due at the end of October. So that funding's all been spent. So the Story Walk Trail, if you haven't walked it, is a short trail that starts behind the library and ends at the school. There are 20 of those signposts that you see there, and they have a plexiglass covering, and you can slide a book page underneath of them. And so you take a book apart page by page and place the pages under that plexiglass, and then you walk the trail and you read the storybook. The photograph in the upper right, the girl in the pink shirt, she's standing in front of her own artwork and a poem that she wrote. And so after our literacy camp, we displayed artwork and poems that the kids wrote in our story walk for a little while. And so the story walk is pretty versatile. It can have books, it can have art. We have lots of ideas for it. The photo, the group photo down at the bottom shows all the volunteers that came and helped the day that we installed the story walk. It was a super wet, drippy summer day, and we had a great turnout and got the story walk installed and the hammock forest also set up too. Then next slide lists STEM kits that we have available, and a sheet up there that is included with one of the STEM kits. So there's all kinds, you can read through the list. The sheet that's shown there is for one called Building Bridges and Buildings. And in each STEM kit, there are some kind of games or activities or materials to make something or do something. And so in that building one, there's a set of these straws with these connectors to build things, and then another building set, and then books, of course. And so there's storybooks as well as nonfiction books about the topic that the STEM kit, the topic of the STEM kit. There are a few STEM kits that are for adults too. We have a pasta making STEM kit and an ice cream making STEM kit. Could be used with kids too, but those have been, well, the ice cream one is new.
What was the one you said?
pasta making. So we've got a pasta maker. So that one's been checked out several times. It's got a drying rack and some special cutters and a recipe book.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So, and they are being checked out. We are going to work on promoting them a little bit more just to try to get them out there a little bit more. I think that people aren't aware of them. So, and then we've always got projects. Some of our current and ongoing projects right now are the Books for Babes and 1,000 Books Before K program. We've got some funding from some donations that we are going to use to fund that program. And that's to promote literacy and ages birth to five. And then the Hammock Reading Forest is ready for a grand opening. We've got all the pieces and parts, it's ready to go. Now we just need sunshine and dry weather, warm weather. Our bike shed project, Mike Taylor has very graciously kind of taken that project on and is going through the steps to get that project underway. That's been a project pre-Leanne and I. We kind of inherited that project, but the idea is to have an outdoor covered bike shed so that when bikers come to the library, they have a dry place to store their bike. And we're going to make it kind of multi-purpose and also use it just as dry space outside for outdoor programming. More literacy camps. Our literacy camp in August was a huge success, and we've got plans for more and want to keep that going. And then, of course, our cataloging project that I mentioned with Melissa. She's working on parts of it. I'm working on parts of it, trying to make the catalog more accurate. And brings us to last couple slides. We're open 5 days a week. On Wednesdays, we have evening hours. On Tuesday, we have morning hours. And then we have a Facebook page. You can contact us by email. Check out our section of the website or stop by. Anybody have any questions for us? Did I miss anything?
No. Your faces as council people in the building is really awesome. We appreciate any time you have. We'll give you tours if you want.
Check out a STEM kit.
Yeah, check out the STEM kit.
Yeah.
Gosh, I know.
Yeah.
We need a good each and have dinner and dessert.
Right, there you go.
Blueberry ice cream during camp. It was a big hit. The ice cream at Group TV.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Great. Yeah.
It's just a good place.
It's always fun.
Well, unless the boiler quits working, right. Then it's not.
That's been a little bit of an issue lately, but we're working on it. Any questions about anything else? I'll send out the PowerPoints and the recording. It might be kind of hard to put it together, but
Yeah.
Thank you for putting it together.
Yeah.
No problem. No problem. We're all here if you have questions. So.
I definitely say that the library is a huge bright spot for
some. Yeah. Nice.
All right, well, I think we'll all be tuning into the train tomorrow as well. It's just gonna do it for you. You go from here too.
Do you know whether it's the same format as what they're going to be having?
No. This is a virtual version. Yes, I will be the same.
Their email is sent out, made it sound like it was sort of a companion training.
Yeah.
So it's imagining they're going to try and do this match somehow.
Right. Yeah, it didn't look like that. It looked like they were only covering some, topics tomorrow, and then probably others of the other Anchorage.
I'm sure it's the email, but I know that starts Zoom.
Oh, the one of Anchorage?
No, the one tomorrow.
Oh, did you not get an email?
No, I did. I just didn't not filling my phone out right now. I don't have the service, so.
Yeah, I think it was from not here. I could pull it up. I got my computer right here.
Yeah, I think it's 9:30.
No, I think it says 9 to 4:30.
9 to 4:30. No.
I'm not gonna change it.
9 to 4:30, huh? Oh, I'm sure they do. They probably have an hour lunch or something.
Asking him what would see a support on this. I want to ask him. No, are you, do you support?
I'm sure it's all about the
Lord. That's what I want to know. What you would like to see us do.
Right.
And do support.
All right, 9 to 4:30. Oh, okay. Well, Janine, I think we're
going to
sign off now.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody. Thanks to Jesse and Leanne for the library presentation and you guys for all the info. And yeah, have a good evening. All right. All righty. All right. There